everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on eminent domain and takings cases right after this. You know, people call the law school regularly, and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, every topic that I cover on the air, I teach in detail in one of my classes. Now, these classes are tailored for busy people in every walk of life, people just like you. For example, when we talk about the origin of the common law, how is the common law applicable today, and how do we use the common law in court, or on the street, or at home, or at work? Where did it come from? Of what value is it in the 21st century? Well, the common law is important because it affects your status, and your status is how you're being taxed. And it's important because it affects your property, or your lack of property. Now, this common law lesson is the first of 46 lessons in my tax and status school. Now, we have three basic goals here in tax and status, and that is, first of all, you need to stay out of jail. Second, you need to save your assets. And third, you need to solve your tax problem once and for all. Now, if you want to live your life peaceably and be left alone, then this tax and status class is designed for you. Why don't you write, call, or wire me and ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll show you why the common law is so important to you and in so many different ways. Now, for more information about my tax and status school and that free general law CD package, why don't you just call and order the free general law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. Doesn't cost you anything to learn. And you can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, the Tax and Status School is available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send an email machine, or send an email over the email machine, and ask for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, the other day, hot off the wire, one of my students sent an email, it's a short 3-pager here, describing a takings case down in Florida. Now, it wasn't described as a takings case in the email, but I thought I'd share it with you because it's a classic. It's one of these classics, and it deals with a thing called pleadings. One of the first things, you know, that the judge asks you to do is, how do you plead to these charges that are brought against you? And there's a lot of pressure put on you to plead. They want you to plead guilty or not guilty. Now, boys and girls, the minute you plead guilty or not guilty, from that moment on, in a factual defense, you can't win. I don't care whether you plead not guilty or guilty, it's irrelevant. You can plead nolo contendere or something else if you want, but from that point on you can't win because you reduce the issue to a clear-cut issue of fact. And the prosecutor is no dummy. He's trained in law. He knows that the minute that you plead, he's got you. And there's a case here that's entitled Panther 1, People 0. Now, the guy that wrote this is a fellow named Henry Lamb. He's the guy that puts out that Ecologic newsletter that I quote from time to time. Henry Lamb is a conservative, pro-property rights, votes a straight Republican or Libertarian ticket. Pretty nice old guy. I've met him a couple of times. But I'm not sure that Henry understands the law and how the law applies in a takings case. So I thought, well, let's take a look. And let's see if you and I can understand how the law works in these takings cases, because this is a pretty common event. And people you know, they write letters to the editor and they get excited and their body juices gel and they have apoplexia and things like that. Well, Henry starts off by saying it's wrong. It's just plain wrong for the federal government to force private landowners not only to allow government panthers to roam on private property, but to let the panthers feast on the landowner's pets. The Third Amendment forbids government from quartering soldiers on private property without the owner's consent. Panthers, however, and other so-called endangered species must be quartered and fed by the landowner without his consent. Now, Jack and David Shealy's petting zoo at their campground near Ocho, it's spelled O-C-H-O-P-E-E, I guess that's Ochopee, Florida, became a buffet table for a radio-collared panther released in the area by the Game Commission. Night after night, the panther jumped the fence into the petting zoo and helped himself to goats, emus, and chickens without the owner's consent. Well, Jack pleaded with the Game Commission to remove the panther, as it had done when another panther pestered pets at a nearby Indian reservation. The Game Commission refused and scolded the Shealys for being in the area that they considered to be panther habitat. Never mind that the Shealys opened their campground in 1971 and never had a problem until the Game Commission decided to release its panthers in the area. So a neighbor, Jan Jacobson, that's Jan Michael Jacobson, it's another man, director of the Everglades Institute, offered to set up a video camera and try to catch the panther in the act. So a videotape of the slaughter, they reasoned, would provide proof positive that this panther should be removed. So on the appointed night, the Shealys staked out a goat in their front yard, and Jacobson set up his camera. And they weren't disappointed either. The panther attacked the goat. Jacobson's camera was rolling, even as he banged on the side of his camper to scare off the panther. The goat survived. Jacobson and the Shealys, however, were hauled into court for conspiring to commit animal cruelty. Now, tying a goat to a stake in the front yard is no more illegal than tying a dog to a stake in the front yard. Putting a spotlight on a goat in the front yard is no more illegal than putting spotlights on the corner of your house. But apparently, both became illegal if a panther attacks the goat. It would not have been illegal, however, had the attacker been a neighbor's dog. The difference is the special rights that Congress has conferred on a wild animal by virtue of the Endangered Species Act. Jacobson cites many scientific studies and concludes that the panther is in no way endangered. It doesn't matter. Once a species has been declared endangered by the government, it is protected. Now, whether it's endangered or not, when the government declares it to be protected, it's protected. Now, had it been a neighbor's dog that gobbled up Shealy's animals, the neighbor would have been responsible for the Shealy's loss and required to pay damages. Why, then, is the government not required to pay the damages caused by the government-owned panther? Well, the Shealys were told that they could go to jail for a year and be fined for the offense unless they pleaded guilty. So they did. They pleaded guilty, and they are now awaiting their sentence. Jacobson did not plead guilty. He had done nothing illegal, so he simply filmed the panther attack, which he and the Shealys had asked the Game Commission to prevent by simply removing the panther. Now, in the posh resort town of Naples, Florida, a six-member jury listened to Jacobson's attorney explain how none of the Jacobson's actions were in violation of any law. And it seemed like a slam dunk for the defense until the pictures from the videotape were shown to the jury. So the jury deliberated for 6 minutes, and they returned a guilty verdict. The prosecution asked for a fine in jail and an extended probation period. The judge fined Jacobson $500 in court costs of $260. Now, the wrong people were on trial. The Game Commission should have been on trial for violating the Sheelys' private property rights. And the jury should have seen photos of all of the slaughtered carcasses of the dozens of privately owned animals that the government-owned panther had killed. Jacobson believes that he has done nothing wrong, and he's going to appeal. And he believes the government is wrong by forcing private individuals to provide food and lodging to wild animals without consent or compensation. Jacobson believes it is wrong to protect an animal as endangered when the same animal is shot as vermin in many other places of the world. Jacobson and the Sheelys are more victims in the long list of people who have been damaged by the Endangered Species Act, which values panthers, wolves, and grizzly bears above human life. Henry Lamb is the executive vice president of the Environmental Conservation Organization and chairman of Sovereignty International. So there's Henry Lamb's take on this panther case down in Florida. Now, I agree with Mr. Lamb. I think that Lamb and the Sheelys and the Jacobsons have been put upon by the government, and that the government should pay for the damages that it causes. And the government will pay for all of the damages. The government will buy every goat that the panther eats. But there's a process that you have to go through in order to succeed in getting the government to pay for this. And I suspect that Mr. Lamb and the Sheelys expect that the government is going to jump up to the plate and say, "Oh my God, here's our checkbook, how much do we owe you for that goat?" Unfortunately, that's not the way the game is played. So let's take a look at this story again in slow motion, and let's go through the process here, and let's see, what did the government do, and what did the Sheelys do, what were they charged with, what was the outcome of the case, and what could we have done differently, playing the game by the rules, which would have given us a different outcome. I suppose that the outcome that we're looking for here, in the case of Mr. Lamb, we want the government, first of all, remove the damn panther. We don't even want the panther in the neighborhood. That could be done. The government could remove that panther, take that panther, and put it someplace else. They do that all the time. When bears up in the national parks, you know, like up in Yellowstone, they get to be too friendly, and they're coming around cabins and places like that. They come out, and they catch them, and they haul them off into a different location. Wolves, you know, same thing, and so there's a process, there's a program that the Fish and Game Commission comes out and they take care of it. I don't know why the Fish and Game Commission didn't take care of this, but let's suppose that we've got skullduggery afoot. Maybe the Fish and Game people are trying to drive the Sheelys out of their private property in the middle of the Everglades National Park. You know, maybe the government has some wicked, evil motive. Maybe it's not the government that has the wicked, evil motive. Maybe it's some agents of the government that have this wicked, evil motive and that ought to be exposed. But is this the way to do it? Well, let's take a look and find out. Let's start over again, paragraph by paragraph. He says it's wrong. It's just plain wrong for the federal government to force private landowners not only to allow government panthers to roam on private property, but to let the panthers feast on the landowners' pets. Well, I'm going to disagree with Mr. Lamb on this first paragraph. This is called eminent domain. Now, eminent domain is one of those topics that gets people's gastric juices to flowing. Let's think about it for a moment. Let's suppose that the government wants to build a freeway from Orlando, Florida to Tallahassee so that you can get up to your state capital. How does the government do that? How do you and I, you know, as people, you know, we want to build a road that goes from Orlando to Tallahassee. How do we do that? Well, we found out that we needed a government in order to do that, because we had to go across other people's private property. You know, there's other people that live between you, you people in Orlando, and the people up in Tallahassee. So we all got together and we formed a government, and we said, now this government's going to have the power of eminent domain, so that when we want to build a road, we'll come in here and we'll condemn your property and build our road. And of course, then the private property people came along and said, yeah, but it ain't fair to us that you should take our property for public use without just compensation. So we came up with, in the Fifth Amendment of our federal constitution, we hammered this out, and we came to this conclusion. When government needs to take a piece of property, and it doesn't have to be land, it could be anything. You know, it could be cattle, it could be sheep or dogs, and it could be, you know, your time in the military. You know, we have a thing called the draft. And the draft, in reality, is just an eminent domain action. We're going to take your time for a couple of years and have you go over here and fight to make America safe for democracy, you know. I mean, stop and think about it. That's what the bottom line is, isn't it? All right, so we came up with this rule. Now, we live in a civilized society, and in our civilized society, we have rules that we go by. All right, so here's the way this game is played. Let's suppose that you live about halfway between Orlando and Tallahassee. Now, the powers that be decide that this freeway needs to go right through your 240 acres of property, right through the middle. And you go, and they come out to you and they say, look, we've been taking some aerial photos and one thing and another. We've decided that we need to build our highway, our freeway, right through your property. And your house is right on the center line of the northbound lanes. So we're gonna take your house and your barn and your yard and lawn and we're gonna take a bunch of acres, you know, about 15 acres of your land to build this freeway through here. But here's what we're going to do. Since we're going to take your house, we're going to figure out what the value of your house is, and we think your house is worth $100,000. And we think that your 15 acres of land is worth about $1,000 an acre, so we're going to give you $115,000. Now, let's suppose that you say that's a fair price. You know, sometimes people come to a conclusion, that seems like a pretty fair price to me, $115,000, I'll take it. And so the government just buys that piece of property from you, builds the freeway, and now you've got a piece of property on the east side and one on the west side. All right, now there's an eminent domain action. And it's carried out, and everybody walks away from the table, and everybody's happy. No complaints about that. All right, let's take that same scenario and let's try it this way. Let's suppose that the government wants to come through your property and they offer you $115,000, but you think your property is worth $230,000 and they're just offering you about 50 cents on the dollar. Well, you don't have to agree with the government's appraisal. You can go get your own appraisal. You know, it's always good to get about three appraisals. And then you can sue the government in an eminent domain action, and you can say, they're not paying me enough money. Take this in front of a jury. Show your three other realtors and your three other bids that your property is worth $230,000, and the jury will decide, a jury of your peers. I know a group of people over here that are your neighbors. They'll decide, is your property worth $230,000, or is it worth $115,000, or is it worth something in between? And they'll give you a number. And then that's the number the government's going to pay you. Now, that's an eminent domain action, but that's a hostile eminent domain action. See, the first one there we had was a friendly one. Yeah, everybody walks away happy. The second one is not quite so friendly. And you're going to get paid what the jury awards. And if the jury awards you $230,000, the government walks away and they're not too happy. And if the jury awards you $115,000, you walk away and you're not too happy. But, you know, that's the break of the game. Now, the reason that we came to this conclusion is scenario number three. Scenario number three. That's where we want to build this freeway from Orlando to Tallahassee, and you don't want to sell. And we don't have any eminent domain action, so we can't build our freeway straight. We have to build our freeway around your property because you won't sell. And there are people like this. I mean, you could come to some guy and he could say, well, I want to, you know, the government comes to you and says, well, we want to buy your property. You say, well, I don't want to sell. And they say, well, we'll give you $115,000, and that's a fair price. And he says, I don't want to sell. And then they say, we'll give you $230,000. I don't want to sell. We'll give you $460,000. I don't want to sell. What are we going to do? Put a dog leg in the freeway? We're going to make a 90-degree left turn west to get around your property? Can you see what our problem is here, boys and girls? I mean, let's be grown-ups about this. So all of us have to agree that in the event that the need arises where we need to build a school, we need to build a freeway, we need to build something, we need to do something over here for public purpose, we got to give way, and the doctrine is called eminent domain. Now, sometimes people get kind of uppity, not too often, but sometimes they get pretty uppity. I saw a guy who was going to build a freeway one time. He wouldn't leave his house. And, you know, they're out here with the Caterpillar tractors ready to bulldoze his house down. He's standing out on the front porch with a gun in his hand. What are you going to do now? You see, at some point in time in a civilized society, we have to have notice and opportunity to defend. We have to have an opportunity to face, confront, and cross-examine our accusers. We have to have just compensation for our property. But, you know, when all of these due process, equal protection, and payments have been made, at some point in time, litigation has to cease. You know, at some point in time, we've got to build the freeway. So what we have to do then is to call the sheriff out. Now, if the sheriff has to kill you and drag your dead ass off that porch, then that's what we're going to do. As you saw in Waco, Texas, Ruby Ridge, Idaho. I mean, you know, if all else fails, if we, you know, life has to go on, boys and girls. If all else fails, then we'll have to kill you. Now, in most cases, that doesn't happen, and it's a very rare event. And when it does, of course, it makes the newspapers. And when a case like this comes up where you got Panther one, people nothing, when we have a wrong, and Mr. Lamb is exactly correct here. He's identified a wrong. And this wrong needs to be corrected. And there is a methodology for correcting it. Now, you can stand on your front porch with a sawed-off shotgun, holding the authorities at bay and the Caterpillar operators, and no, you're not going to build your freeway through my property. Now, that's one way that you can handle it. I would suggest to you that there's probably a better, simpler, more profitable methodology than that. But there's three examples. Now, say we got a school, we're going to build a school. You wouldn't be objecting to a school being built, would you? We need your property for a school, and it's just kind of centrally located. And there's been some eminent domain cases come up just recently. In fact, I think it was in 2004. The Michigan Supreme Court said that when cities are condemning property, using eminent domain to take people's houses, condemn whole neighborhoods so they can build Holiday Inns and more tax-efficient Walmarts and et cetera, that they can't do that, period. You can't take it. Well, those are political and legal decisions that are made by legislatures. I don't know. I'm just little Georgie Gordon out here, and I happen to be sitting along a highway here called 160, and they've been talking for years about straightening the road out. See, the road goes around my property. I'll just bet you years ago when the Smiths owned this property way back in the olden days that when they went to build Highway 160, which used to be a buffalo trail, and the buffalo stayed on the high ground and they just kind of walked where it was easiest for a buffalo to walk. They weren't thinking about building a road, so they followed that buffalo trail. Well, it's kind of a windy road, 160 is, and they've been talking about straightening it out. When they do, they're going to go right straight through my property. They're just going to come right through my property and take several acres of my ground for about a half a mile, and they're going to pay me something for it. And I'm not going to like that. Let me tell you right now, I don't want my house on one side and my land on the other. But, you know, when push comes to shove, being a civilized man and all, I understand that the people of Missouri have a right to have a straight road. And if that's the decision that the body politic makes, is that we want a straight road from Theodosia to Gainesville, and it runs right through Gordon's property. Hell, it's going to run right through Smith's property. It's going to run right through Ushman's property. It's going to run, you know, all my neighbors are impacted by this road too, you know. But when you think about it, thousands of people are going to be using this straight road. So it's going to be a benefit to thousands of people, and it's going to be a nuisance to 10 or 15 of us. And so we agreed years ago that when there's a nuisance to 10 or 15 and a benefit for thousands, that we would go with the benefit for thousands, and the 10 or 15 will have to tough it out. And I'm prepared to tough it out. The only thing I'm concerned about is, am I going to get paid a fair amount for my inconvenience? Are you thousands of people out there prepared to pay me for splitting my land in two? And are you going to build a causeway underneath it so I can get my cows from one side of the road to the other? And things like that. Now, I'm entitled to that, and the law provides for that, and I have every confidence, boys and girls, every confidence that when they build that road, I've been talking about it for 20 years, and hell, I'm probably going to die before it happens, but assuming that it happens, and I have every confidence that I'm going to get the causeway underneath the road, and that I'm going to get paid a fair amount for my land. And I'm not concerned at all about it. It's a part and parcel of life. You know, there was a time 100 years ago before Highway 160 was here, and then there's Highway 160 is here, and then one of these days they're going to have Freeway 160. You know, as time goes on, the landscape changes. As time goes on, more and more people come in. Cities grow. And more people in cities have greater and greater needs, and this is what eminent domain is all about. And the Sheelys here, or Sealys, are going to have to get used to the fact that maybe their petting zoo is in the way of a higher and more profitable, more public-oriented use of the land, for which these people need to be paid. So let's talk about how do you get paid. And that's really where the bottom line is. I think most of us would agree. Now, we may disagree on what should be taken or what shouldn't be taken for eminent domain. My thinking has been along that with the Supreme Court, that if the state wants to take it and they just want to let it lie fallow, they can do that. If the government was to take this land in your neighborhood and they want to build a box store, a Holiday Inn, for higher tax purposes, they can do that. Now, the people have gotten up in arms lately, and they said, well, we don't mind you taking it for freeways, we don't mind you taking it for schools, but we don't want you taking it for McDonald's or Walmart or for a higher tax base. And the Supreme Court of Michigan agreed with the people, and that's a political decision, and I'm not here to argue with people's politics. I'm just here to tell you this is the way the rules of the game are played. And these people here aren't playing this game by the rules. That's why they're having a problem. But the government isn't playing this game by the rules either. And so one side or the other needs to haul the other side in and make them play this game by the rules. And if we do that, I think it'll come out a lot better. Now, Mr. Lamb points out that the Third Amendment forbids government from quartering soldiers on private property without the owner's consent. Panthers, however, and other so-called endangered species must be quartered and fed by the landowner without his consent. I'm going to dissent from that conclusion, Mr. Lamb, again, because the Third Amendment is irrelevant and immaterial to the issue at hand. Now, the issue at hand is the taking of the Sheely's animals, not the quartering of panthers or troops. And the Third Amendment, if you raise it in court, is a collateral issue that really doesn't have any merit. The Fifth Amendment is where we want to zero in. Zero in on the Fifth Amendment. Zero in on the taking. The government has a panther. The first thing we've got to do is identify the owner of the panther. That's the very first thing you got to do. I think if I was this person, I would go to the fish and game people and say, I think there's a panther over here on my place eating my sheep. do you have any panthers in the area? And the fish and game people may say, no, we don't have any panthers at all. Oh, well, then you wouldn't be opposed to me shooting and killing a panther that's taking my lambs, would you? And the fish and game would say, no, we don't have any objection to you shooting panthers or grizzly bears or whatever the hell is killing your sheep. Okay? So that's no problem, is it? Now, what if the fish and game people say, oh my God, yes, that's our radio-collared Black Panther, and he's worth thousands of dollars, and he's a part of an endangered species, and my God, don't you dare touch our panther. Oh, okay. Well, now we've identified ownership, haven't we? Now, at this point in time, we don't know whether it's this radio-collared panther that's killing our goats or whether it's somebody else killing our goats. And it could be a grizzly bear. It could be the neighbor's dogs. Now, I've got sheep here, and every once in a while I go out and count my sheep, and I notice that one or two of them are missing, and I say, uh-huh. But I don't rush off and jump off the deep end here and say, well, my God, it must be the fish and game people turning black bears loose. I don't know what happened to that lamb. Now, most often it's dogs. Most often it's dogs that and two dogs make a pack. And people have a soft spot for dogs. We'll talk about dogs a little later, and dogs and my sheep a little later. And I'll show you how we take care of dogs here out in the countryside. We don't have a lot of problem. Now, if I had a radio-collared bear, now they have turned some bears loose, black bears, down here in Arkansas. And somebody told me the other day they saw a cougar over here on HH, for crying out loud. And I thought, well, I don't know. You know, people brag a lot and they talk a lot. Now, you'd think that if there was any cougars or black bears around here, they'd be in my sheep, and they haven't been yet. Now, I'm kind of sitting here waiting, and one of these days, I'm going to go out here, and there's going to be sheep carcasses all over, and when there is, there's going to be hell to pay. When George Gordon's sheep are laying all over my North 40, by God, there's going to be some talk about that. And I'm going to be looking for who's killing my sheep. And when I find out, I'm going to make them pay for it. And I don't care whether it's the Department of Natural Resources in Arkansas, or I don't care if it's in Missouri, or if it's the neighbor's dogs. They're going to pay for George Gordon's sheep. Now let's take our break here, and we'll come back, and we'll figure out a way to make these guys pay for their deprivations. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, simply call The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or the radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, tonight we're talking about eminent domain and takings cases, and we're reviewing an article written by Henry Lamb, sent to me by Kathleen, one of my students. Kathleen's observation, she said, looks like the first mistake was submitting the case to a findings of fact before the judge and jury instead of a matter of law. I think Kathleen is exactly correct, that what's happened here is that the government has reduced the controversy to a single clear-cut issue of fact. did the Sheelys and Jacobson commit an act of animal abuse, and for which the Sheelys pled guilty. So then they admitted that they committed animal abuse, and so it's an open and shut case. You see, the government has a panther roaming around. Now let's just think about it for a minute. Let's suppose that our local fish and game commission has a black bear running around in my neighborhood here, and that black bear is out here killing my sheep. So I go into the fish and game and I say, listen, your bear is out here killing my sheep, and here's the count, 6 so far. And they say, well, we're not going to pay you, and if you do anything to our bear, we're going to prosecute you for killing an endangered species or violating the statute. Okay, now look at our dilemma. We got a law here that says thou shalt not kill this bear. See, in the olden days, when people came out here and claimed this land to begin with, it was already full of bears. It was full of mountain lions. So your great-great-great-granddaddy came out here about 1840, and he said, well, this looks like pretty good land out here. He said, I'd like to settle here. And so he claimed his 80 acres, or 160 a little later, and built a fence around it and built a house, and he went to work on it. Now, he woke up one day and he said, you know, I need to have a milk cow here. And he went out and he bought a milk cow. And then he brought the milk cow home, and the milk cow had a calf, and a bear came in and ate the calf. And so old granddad, he woke up one day, not being a very practical fellow, he says, you know, there isn't room here for me and that bear. So he got his gun, and he went out and he killed the bear. And his neighbors did the same thing. See, all the neighbors, they wanted to have milk cows too. They wanted to have sheep and goats and cows and chickens and pigs and one thing and another, and the bears and the cougars, they were free to live there as long as they didn't eat the chickens and the cows and the pigs and the calves and the sheep. But you know, animals, wild animals, and particularly predators, they want to eat the easiest thing there is to kill. And it's a hell of a lot easier to go out here and kill a lamb or a sheep than it is to go out here and kill some wild boar. So the conflict then between the settlers, the old timers that came out here, was that the old timers, the settlers, they had to wrest a living off of the land. At the end of the year, they were going to eat through the winter and spring and the summer what it is they collected in the fall. And if they didn't collect it, they would starve to death because they didn't have WPA. The Conservation Corps and welfare and food stamps and aid to families with dependent children. They had to produce for themselves. They ate what they produced. They did not eat what other people produced. They ate what they produced. It was a wild new concept to most people today. And as a result, they killed off all the bears in the mountain lions. When it was all said and done, it was people 16, mountain lions 0. No mountain lions. They just eradicated them. And that went on quite nicely because, you see, the people could live nicely without mountain lions, but they could not live nicely without sheep, without cattle, without milk, meat, butter, eggs. And in our civilized society, our founding fathers, they believed that meat, milk, butter, and eggs was more important than grizzly bears and panthers. And in the process of time, they became wealthy. They had lots of sheep and lots of cattle and lots of land and lots of chickens and lots of pigs. And they had lots of children. And those children went to college and they learned to be wildlife biologists. Now, a wildlife biologist has about as much use in life as tits on a boar hog. Those are people that suck off the government. They produce nothing and consume much. But they're a necessary part of civilized society. And that's because when people start out in life, they start out poor and they work hard and they make a lot of money. Then when they make a lot of money, they become degenerate. And they go to college. And then they don't want to work anymore. And people that go to college don't want to work. They want to suck off of others. It's the way life is. Let's face reality. And government workers don't produce anything, but they consume much. Now, in the olden days, we had a thing called limited government. There weren't very many people working for the government, and we had lots of people out here working, making meat, milk, butter, and eggs. As time went on, we came to the conclusion that we needed more people working in government. So we had to have more and more colleges to train more and more people to work in government. And as we have more and more colleges, we have to have more and more professors, and these more and more professors have to have more and more subjects, more and more subjects. One of them came up to be a wildlife biologist. Now, what does a wildlife biologist do? Well, he doesn't do very much, and he does that very slow, and he collects a lot of money. And, of course, lazy people who don't want to work want to go to college, get a degree, go to work for the government so they can stand around the water cooler, drink water, shoot the breeze, and collect a lot of money and do very little for it. And wildlife biologists fit right into that program. And so the wildlife biologist says, well, gee, in the olden days, they used to have panthers down here in the Everglades. And the old-timers came in here and killed all the panthers off. I think that panthers in the Everglades are an endangered species, and we ought to have a law. So they went to Congress, and they said, hey, we ought to have a law. Now, by now, most of the people who were the sons and daughters of those early pioneers that killed off all of those panthers and bears in the Everglades now have their children educated in college, living in the cities, standing around the water coolers, drinking water, producing nothing or damn little. And they woke up one day and said, oh, my God, in the olden days when our grandfathers came into this land, there were grizzly bears and black bears and panthers. And we should have grizzly bears and black bears and panthers because none of these people raise sheep and cattle, and they buy their milk and meat and butter and eggs at the grocery store. And because they don't produce, they don't see the connection between the bears and the panthers killing the calves and the sheep that their great-great-granddaddies did. So their perspective in life is totally different today in 2005 than it was 100 years ago in 1905, isn't it? 1905, we were out here trying to claim this land and raise cattle and make our meat, milk, butter, and eggs off of our labor. Today, we get our meat, milk, butter, and labor eggs off of the labor of Mexicans working in factory farms in North Carolina. And we buy it at Kroger's. While we stand at the water cooler shooting the breeze, collecting all of this money that the government creates to hire people like us, you know, the wildlife biologists, to reestablish endangered species in places. Now, the Sheelys happen to live out here in the country someplace. See, they're still living out here in the country. They're way, way behind the times. And because they're living out in the country and they have this petting zoo out here, as the wildlife biologists and the people that live in the cities who are clapping their hands and jumping up and down with glee that we now are reestablishing these panthers. Now, none of these people in the cities ever go out into the countryside and watch these panthers. I mean, when was the last time you went out into the Everglades to watch the black panthers of Florida? You're like these fools that are opposed to drilling for oil up in Alaska in the Anwar National Refuge. When was the last time you visited the Anwar National Refuge? When was the last time you hiked and walked and picnicked up in the Anwar Tundra and enjoyed the serene beauty of the Alaska wilderness? The answer is none of you have ever been there. Most of you couldn't find it with a road map in both hands at high noon. And you know it as well as I do. Now, you're all pulling into the gas station, fueling up with gas, and then you're jumping up and down, complaining about drilling for oil up there. You know, people don't always make a lot of sense. Now, Henry Lamb makes a lot of sense. Now, Henry Lamb says, this isn't right. Hell, any of us can see this isn't right. Now, the question is, well, what's the solution? When you got it wrong, we need a solution. So let's concentrate on solutions. And there's a solution to this. But before we get to the solution, let's see if we can understand what's causing this problem. The problem today is being caused by a lot of people who are misinformed and ill-informed as to the nature of these panthers out here in the Everglades. And the people today have come to the conclusion that we need more panthers and less goats and sheep. I don't know if that conclusion is right or wrong. But the people of America have decided that we need a whole lot more wildlife biologists and a whole lot more panthers than we need. Sheep and cattle and goats and farmers out here producing the meat, milk, butter, and eggs out on the land. We've come to that conclusion. I think that it's a bad conclusion and a wrong decision, but then, you know, who am I? I could sit here and say, I think that putting Highway 160 through George Gordon's farm is a wrong decision. But, you know, look, boys and girls, if the majority of the people around me say, we'd like to straighten that road out, okay, pay me. Now, if the government wants to turn panthers loose down here on the Shealy's land, don't you think the government should come in and buy the Shealy's land to put their panthers? Now, my neighbor Don Uchman over here the other day came over and he said, hey, Gordon, you know that 12 acres you got on the other side of the creek? Why don't you sell that to me? He said, it ain't doing you no good. And you just have to go over there and fence it off, and it's on the other side of the creek, and it's on my side. So why don't you sell that to me? That makes all sense in the world, doesn't it? 12 acres I can't use and 12 acres that he could use. Now, if the government wants to use that, like my neighbor over here, they ought to come over and offer to buy it. Say, look, Mr. and Mrs. Shealy, we'd like to put our panthers out here in the Everglades, and your farm is just right smack dab in the middle of the Everglades National Forest out here, the Everglades National Park, or whatever we're calling it, and we want to raise our panthers out here. Why don't you move to the city? Why don't we give you $1 million? Why don't you blow it off someplace and get the hell out of here? Evidently, the government does not want to pay these people the price that this land is worth. And, you know, from the government bureaucrat's position, let's take the Fish and Game Department. They get a budget every year, and it's $5 million, let's say. And maybe the Shealy's property over here is worth $1 million. And we want to drive the Shealy's out of here, but we don't want to pay them $1 million. Did it ever occur to you that government agencies and officials could sometimes have an ulterior motive involved here? We want to drive you out, and we want to pay you little or nothing for your property. We want to make your property worth as little as possible. Well, you know, if you've got wild animals marauding around out there, and then you come along and say, well, would you like to buy my house just because a couple of people have been killed or mauled, you know, in the last 6 months here from mountain lions here in California? This is a real neat, nice neighborhood. It depreciates. It depresses property values, boys and girls. Then the government could come in and say, well, now that the property value is depressed, and you get your three real estate brokers over here saying, we couldn't give this piece of property away, the government can then come in and buy it at a song, can't they? I say government. It isn't that the government, which is an abstract thought in our minds. It's these government agents. Now, not all government agents are bad agents. Sometimes government agents come out and say, listen, we want to buy this piece of property and we think this is a fair price. Sell it. Other government agencies are dealing under the table saying, well, I've got a budget constraint and I'm not going to pay you for it. And they're doing that out in the West all the time. They're driving ranchers off of their ranches out there using these kinds of tactics. Using the heavy-handed coercion of government agents charging people with crimes, making life so miserable that these people just give up and quit and move to the cities. Then the government comes and takes their land by adverse possession. Won't pay them anything for it. I don't think that's right, but you know, that's the way the world works. And we might as well wake up to that reality. It's the way the world works. So, I'm well aware that when the government comes through here to build their freeway through my farm, that they may come in with a checkbook, or they may come in with crimes and charges against me. I don't know. When the time comes, I'll have to face it, won't I? Just like these people. Now, Jack and David Shealy's petting zoo at their campground near Okeechobee, Florida, became a buffet table for a radio-collared panther released in the area by the Game Commission. All right, now, that's an allegation. I don't know, you know, if I'm sitting on the jury or I'm the judge, I don't know if this buffet table is for a pack of dogs over here that belong to some neighbors, or if it's this radio-collared panther released in the area by the Game Commission. I mean, just because this panther's been released in this area by the Game Commission doesn't mean the panther's eating the goats, does it? I mean, I got black bears around here, and I lost some sheep this year. How do I know that it's the black bear that's killing the sheep? Now, most of the time, it's dogs. Now, I've been here for 20 years, and I've never seen a black bear yet. So, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I don't like the idea of these panthers and bears being in my area, but you know, the people of Missouri and Arkansas have spoken. They've said they want black bears and panthers. Well, not panthers here, but they got mountain lions. And they've turned some of them loose. Now, so far as I know, as far as I can tell, none of these bears or cougars have eaten any of my sheep. But as soon as I get wind of the fact that some of them are, boy, I'm going to be hot on the trail. But, you know, I'm just Joe Q citizen like everybody else, and I'm opposed to turning all these damn wild animals loose in my neighborhood. But then, you know, shucks, most people don't live out here on the land anymore, boys and girls. We need to face facts. In 1920, 42 or 43%, 42% of the people of America lived on the land. Today, 3% live on the land. 97% of you people are locked up in the cities. 97% of you people want bears and cougars out here on the land. I'm not sure why you want these bears and cougars out here on the land. Well, somebody came up and said, well, they're endangered species. Well, so is the saber-toothed tiger and the mammoth. But then, do we want saber-toothed tigers running around? Now, over in India, they got tigers. And they've got other wild animals over there. They've got cobras, and cobras kill 25,000 people a year. Now here in America, we got after the rattlesnakes and the poisonous snakes, and we killed every poison snake we could find. And poison snakes aren't very common here in the United States. I imagine one of these days somebody's going to come up with the idea that the rattlesnake is an endangered species, and we need to breed and turn more of them loose. And, of course, for you people living in the cities, that's no problem. Rattlesnakes don't care much for Times Square and Madison Avenue, but they really like wood piles, and they kind of like it out here in the countryside. Now, if the fish and game people, you know, were to breed up 20,000 of these rattlesnakes and start turning them loose here in the local area, I wouldn't like that. And the minute they call these rattlesnakes an endangered species and start turning them loose out here, you know, that poses a problem. Then they're going to say, well, if we catch you killing one of these rattlesnakes, we'll fine you $500. Well, that ought to tell you that you got a problem here and you got to solve it. And I'm going to tell you how to solve that rattlesnake problem. I'll tell you how to solve that bear problem and wolf problem and cougar problem. There's, you know, we farmers out here in the countryside, we don't have any problems out here with radio-collared animals. We know exactly how to take care of them animals. And I'm going to describe how my neighbor takes care of them. We'll do that in the next program, but I want to point out here that Jack and David Shealy's petting zoo at their campground. Now, night after night, the panther jumped the fence into the petting zoo and helped himself to goats, emus, and chickens without the owner's consent. God, without the owner's consent. I like the prose here. Well, that leaves me with the impression that there's a bunch of neighbors down here next to Jack and David Shealy's petting zoo, and some of the neighbors have given permission for the panther to jump over their fences and eat their emus and their goats and their chickens, but the Shealys didn't give permission, and this damn cat, instead of going over and eating at the neighbors where he has permission, is coming over here and eating where he doesn't have permission. Now, come on, boys and girls, that panther is going to eat wherever he wants to eat. You know, it's like kind of like the old story, where does an 800-pound gorilla sit? Any damn place he wants to. Where does an 800-pound gorilla eat? He eats any place he wants to. And where does this 400 or 500-pound panther eat? Well, he eats at the Shealy's petting zoo. That's where he eats. So, in looking at that, I say, okay, we're pretty well convinced based upon the sign. Now, what happens is this. You go out in the field and you see an animal dead. Well, you look at it and you say, well, I can see he's dead. Now, what killed him? Now, if you see this animal is half eaten, well, you can see that, well, he's half eaten. Well, does that mean that the animal died and then the coyotes came over and ate on the carcass? Does that mean that the coyotes came over and killed the animal and ate the carcass? Does that mean that a panther came over and killed the animal and ate half the carcass? I mean, you know, if you're going to go into court, you got to have some evidence. Now, typically, you'll see sign. Now, if it's a cat that killed him, you're going to see scratch marks on this animal. You'll see that the hide is torn with these claws. You won't find that with a coyote, and you won't find that with dogs. Now, when dogs kill an animal, you'll see that the animal has been bitten. You'll see that there are signs that this animal has been killed. Didn't just die now. It didn't just fall over. Now, I had a ewe down here the other day, and I could see that she was a little on the sicky side. I looked at her, and she wasn't with the rest of the flock, and that's a signal. That's a signal that she's sick or that she's going to lamb. So I watched her for a day, and she didn't lamb, and she laid down. She couldn't get up. Well, come find out, you know, she was an old ewe. She'd been around here for about 10 or 15 years. And she just died of old age, and it just takes 2 or 3 days for an old ewe to die of old age, and she finally died, and then the buzzards came in, cleaned her carcass off. Well, now, that's normal. See, I see things like that every once in a while. Not very often that an old ewe like that lives to die of old age, but once in a while they do. Now, when the dogs get after them down there, you're going to see this animal laying out in the middle of the field or up next to a fence. And you go down there and you look at it and you'll see that this animal here has been killed. Now, when an animal has been killed, then you say to yourself, well, what was it? Was it a cougar? Was it a bear? Was it dogs? Was it coyotes? Now, coyotes kill animals once in a while, but not very often. They kill lambs, but they don't kill full-grown sheep. All right, now, evidently the Sheelys here, or Sheelys, Sheelys, S-H-E-A-L-Y-S, could look at the sign on the animals and see that it was a panther that had killed these animals. So Jack pleaded with the game commission. So he walked in to the game commission to remove the panther, as it had done when another panther pestered pets at a nearby Indian reservation. Now, there's a clue. Now, evidently, the Indians have a lot more clout than the Sheelys, because when the panther got over here on the Indian reservation, they moved him. Now, the Indians have a treaty with the United States. Under the terms of the treaty, under the terms of the contract with the United States, this panther was posing a problem to this private Indian land under contract, and the government took action. The Sheelys don't have this contract. Isn't that just real special? They're taxpayers, but they're not the people who have the same rights or capacities as do the Indians. Now, why is that? Well, we're about out of time here, boys and girls, and we'll have to cut it off right here. We'll come back and we'll take a look at this issue again next time. We're talking about eminent domain and takings cases. So, let me give you a reminder as we leave the air, and we'll be back here tomorrow night talking about this same topic. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. And we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.